Galileo. I thought you would. I think this one has just the right amount of time. But I particularly like the screenshot of my little castle. And of course, and before it, just a little south of a little bit south of Krakow, the screenshot. Yeah, that's the one. But I do my best thinking in the winter, so my favorite spot, that's my favorite. You know, that picture looks a little bigger than that, but it's a lot smaller than that. Yeah. But about 5 years ago, we got broadband internet access to our campus. And I've been catching up on things, you know, 465 years. Without much information, I've been catching up on things. One of the first things that I think I'm going to do is take this hat off. If President Kennedy doesn't have to wear a hat anymore, I don't. I'd like to say is, viewing all the changes since I was last in the I'd like to say that the 20th century had its own problems because it was just too good at something. Yeah. I know I was following the faggots and you got all excited about numbers. Heard about that, you got all excited about it. I said, all is numbers. Getting a little bit too excited about something that does a good thing for you. And I think the 20th century problem in physics is based on two things that are really, really very good, but exaggerated by the people who found so much pleasure in them. One is technologically advanced observations. A lot of technologically advanced observations kept getting better and better and better in the century, but the limitations of those observations get in the way of theory. Second thing is high-end mathematics. It's so beautiful, and it's so complicated, and those who practice it know, nobody else can understand it, that you can get away with a lot, and you can project a lot with high-end mathematics. Now, I'd like to talk about a little bit of those observations that I have based on that. So, first thing I like to talk about is the fundamental particle. The 20th century started off with the pursuit of the atom. And I thought that was very fascinating for them, since the atom is a Greek idea. And the idea is that the atom is indestructible. Indestructible. So, early in the 20th century, it was found to be the level below the molecule. And then, it got destroyed. And people put up. The Greeks were wrong. The atom can be destroyed. It's got all kinds of little parts in it. We'll call them neutrons, protons, electrons, so on. So, the atom was destroyed. Of course, the Greeks said it was indestructible. It couldn't be destroyed. That's just the way it is. So, actually, what was the theory behind it? The theory behind the indestructibility of the atom is that the logic of the streakness in the universe means that there has to be something which doesn't get destroyed, which doesn't ever change. Now, what does that mean? Well, the first thing is, if you feel right about it, it means that it can't heat up. It can't get hotter or colder. If it can't heat up, it means it doesn't have any parts. If it doesn't have any parts, it's going to behave different than almost everything that we know. So, how big is the atom? Right now, because we are so proud of our technological advancements, we've gotten down, and as the century went on, the fundamental particles have gotten smaller and smaller, as the atom, the protons, and the electrons. Now, the protons are broken down to quarks, but if think we are about quadrillion times in scale away from the fundamental particle. Because the fundamental particle should behave in a certain way, and that way is that if you have an effect on it, it should only have forward momentum or angular momentum. It cannot do that. Can't internalize the momentum. And there's only one thing that behaves like that, and that's what Heisenberg talked about in his uncertainty principle. At the level of Planck constant, you cannot tell what the velocity is and the size of something at the same time, because when you impact something, it moves away. So, it seems that that's a really good place to look for a fundamental particle. Unfortunately, it's quadrillions of times too small for our equipment. But let's think about it for a little while. How could we ever know or even see a fundamental particle? We have a 20th century observation. If we can't observe it, we can't know it. But we can extrapolate, that's what everybody does. There's electric there before. There's a lot of extrapolation about intelligent life on other planets without those observations. So let's do a little bit more of that. If the fundamental particle were to be seen, how would you see it? Because how do we see anything? I see you see me by bouncing off trillions and trillions of smaller objects, and they bounce back and give you an idea. So if you were at the fundamental particle level, to see it, you have to bounce another fundamental particle off of it, and you wouldn't get much information, because you don't get much information when you bounce one thing that's the same size off of another. So what would happen would be the momentum, as you bounce it, would be projected onto the new particle. So, the first thing that I think is important to understand about the search for fundamental particles is that the scale is probably off by quadrillions in terms of scale. Now, let's just make the assumption that that's true for a second, and that photons and neutrinos, by the way, I read 20 years ago, people didn't think they had mass. Time to think about they had mass. Let's talk about that for a second. Mass and energy have been the fundamental concept driving 20th century physics, among others. But mass and energy are changeable into each other, according to Einstein's theory. Now, if something can be changed from one form into another, is that a fundamental enough idea for the fundamental theory of explaining it? I think not. And I think not for this reason. It's a little bit like water and ice. Water and ice. You could say you can change one into the other. But what's H2O? It tells us sort of what's in common, and that water and ice and water vapor are just different forms of the same thing at different internal velocities, internal temperatures, internal velocities. Now, if you take an object, and you're concerned about the relative velocity, if something is sort of traveling at exactly your velocity, that may be what looks like mass to us. And anything that's traveling at the speed of light looks like energy to us. Now, neutrinos were traveling at almost the speed of light, and it was only when we had better refined observations and skills that we began to see there's a little bit of mass in those neutrinos because they're traveling at the speed of light. But what if photons, which are light, what if photons are made of quadrillions of these more fundamental particles? And that a photon is actually like a lot of the forms of structure in the universe. A lot of the forms of structure in the universe are those vaguely spherical, with a denser center and more vague outlines around it, like lighter, less and less dense. Almost every form in the universe is like that. And if the photons were like that, then one, they would act and they spun as they move. And they would act a lot like the dual nature of light is, which is they would act like a particle and they would also act like a wave at this time. Now, I just think that there's some other ways that we can take a look at this and try to figure out, maybe in a different structure, how that fits together. Now, if you take this concept about the fundamental particles being quadrillions of signs off of the scale that we are using right now, and you say that things are made of those much more fundamental particles, how would that affect the rest of our theory? The one is the speed of light. It's very interesting that Einstein made the speed of light an absolute. He dumped the idea that time was an absolute. He dumped the idea that space was an absolute. But he made the speed of light an absolute. Now, I'm perfectly aware from my reading that 100 million times since Nicholson Morley, light has always been found to be the same in event. That's why it's called a limit. However, velocity behaves as a relative phenomenon in every other way possible. And we know that the motion of stars, that Jeff and others were talking about, the motion of stars, and even visibility to tell whether there's a planet, depends upon the red and blue shifting that takes place between the velocity. And therefore, the amount of work that the light that comes from does, it is affected in the same relative way that everything else. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later. But it seems to me that we're not quite understanding both mass and energy in a way that allows us to come to a good answer about this. And I think the 21st century, I predict, will come to an answer. And I think that the answer is going to be something like very, very tiny fundamental particles, and that everything is made of a momentum. Now, one of the other things would be that that's the answer is the forces. We know what the nuclear, we don't have a clear idea about where the forces come from. But if there were quadrillions of very tiny particles whipping around the center of a nucleus, that momentum would hold the nucleus together. Now, what happens when an atomic explosion takes place? What we say now in the 20th century is that mass is converted into energy. And I will make another prediction that by the end of the 21st century, we will no longer say that. We will say that the momentum of quadrillions or quintillions of very tiny fundamental particles, that their momentum has been disrupted, and they all took off in the directions that they would have gone at that time, but that would cause the explosion. Now, what other effects would that idea have? Electricity, we know, is the motion, caused the motion of bioelectrons. But what about gravity? We don't really have an answer for gravity. So, when we think about gravity, we work off of Einstein's theory. But if everything in our solar system, in the galaxy, and so on, was composed of quadrillions more particles than we thought, all of which have momentum, all of which are unseeable by us, more or less, and that that momentum was whipping around the sun as well, or around the galaxy, and so on, but that momentum would keep the structures in place. Now, let's talk about black holes for a second, since they're very popular. Black hole has something which everyone gets excited about, especially when they're teenagers, and that is the time horizon. That is, that there is a line over which you can't escape, but also that time will start to reverse itself. This I found most interesting because it's based upon an assumption. And the assumption is that the speed of light is an absolute. Speed of light being an absolute, it's the best thing to measure something with, so we measure time with it. If that assumption is incorrect, and light is not, the speed of light is not an absolute, then the mathematics that causes us to describe black holes this way will disappear, and they'll become much more noisy. And if the fundamental particle is quadrillions of times smaller than what we assume now, black holes will be able to condense to a much smaller size before they would explode, than they do now. The idea of the singularity, of blessing to a singularity, is also based on the mathematics of the speed of light being an absolute, and therefore, I think that that will disappear. Instead, the black holes will look just like a very intense form of any other concentration of mass and momentum, and it will continue to get smaller and smaller because of that spin momentum, as long as there is more new material coming in. It's a little bit like boiling water on the stove. As long as you're putting cold water into the boiling water, it will never boil altogether. But if there's no more material coming in, then it will collapse to the small thing and then it will explode. I predict that the Big Bang will be considered to be the explosion of a black hole. And you won't be able to tell how many there are, but I think that redefining that place in the universe, you might discover that there's not just one Big Bang, probably then. Now, why can you say something like that? Well, another possibility here is that if you take the concept about the Big Bang and this concept, which you'll hear a lot about from Alan Shore, how to figure out why the universe looks the way it does now, the mathematics tells us that there must be dark energy and dark matter to create the effect of the acceleration of the universe as we see it from the galaxy. And that's a great picture, I'm sure. But I want you to think about that. There are probably other ways to explain the acceleration of those galaxies. One thing to look at would be the Magellanic Cloud from as they're coming towards our galaxy. Their mass is being accelerated by the Milky Way. So another possible explanation would be a high concentration of mass where those galaxies are, that if it starts to accelerate up towards it, which we cannot see. And as the theory about the runaway universe is, if things have to keep expanding as they are, we will not be able to see large portions of what we used to be able to see. So there easily could be something out there. That's one possible explanation. There's another. The way that the Big Bang is described and the way that these galaxies are described, by a little visual here, if there's an explosion from the central part, it would stand out like this. But it would stand out in waves. We kind of know what it would be. If it's in space, it would go in all directions. And so that explosion takes place. And let's just say there's all layers of it, and almost any explosion, the kind of last burst of the explosion collapses back onto the center. There's enough force for the explosion, but not enough that it kind of collapses back. Now, let's just say that the Earth and our galaxy is in the third wave out of 15 waves that are moving out of this explosion. We're sitting up here looking back, and we know when we see those galaxies that are highly red-shifted, that it was 12 billion years ago that they were highly red-shifted. 12 billion years ago, so we're looking at something that happened 12 billion years ago, much closer to the explosion, and it is going to have to be a wave of the explosion after us. We were expelled first, or we wouldn't be able to look back and see it. So we're sitting out here having been expelled first, expelled at a higher speed. And those parts of the universe that are also galaxies are moving in our direction, but not as fast as we are. From our point of view, it looks like they're receding and being red-shifted, but they're not probably coming as fast. And if they won't start to recede, then they will start to expel us. But it actually could be that they're not expanding the universe, but the original explosions are collapsing back just a possible way of looking at it. Now, a couple of other random observations. Quantum mechanics and relativity theory have not been able to be joined. There are several reasons probably for that. But one thing about quantum mechanics that I think to be said is a form of probability theory. One of the most effective tools for predicting things in the future, and I think the reason for that is simple. If you have quadrillions and quintillions of tiny particles, that is going to be very effective for probability theory being able to predict what's going to happen because it fits right into what probability theory is doing. Okay. Another thing is we will never see the universe. So we'll never see the fundamental particles, and we'll never ever be able to see the universe. I know we'd all like to have sort of that shot, like from the moon of the Earth, of the whole universe. But it will never happen because to see the universe, you must have something to bounce off of, light to bounce off of, all the light in the universe. You cannot be outside of bouncing things off and getting a picture. There's no amount of pixels that would do that. Because there'll be no light coming back to you. So one thing that I wanted to say is just to invite the 21st century physics. Everything hasn't been determined. There's a lot of creative ways of looking at the data, and
trying to understand the data from another point of view. And I think the most important thing is to be scientific. It's very hard to really be scientific. It's much easier to have a sort of religious fervor that's based on a fear that what you believe in your whole life is wrong. And that happens in science as well as in religion. But just hold your assumptions lightly. And be bold. Be bold